And joining us today is Patricia Park. Patricia is the author of Re-Jane, and this is a book that is kind of, some people say it's a little bit like a modern version of Jane Eyre, and we'll talk with Patricia about that. But let me tell you a little bit about Patricia. Patricia was born and raised in Queens, graduated from the Bronx High School of Science. She earned her BA in English from Swarthmore College and MFA in fiction from Boston University. Former Fulbright Scholar and Emerging Writer Fellow at the Center for Fiction. She's published essays in the New York Times, Slice, and The Guardian, and she has also taught writing at the Boston University, at Queens College, and at Ewell Women's University, and she currently lives in Brooklyn. Patricia, thank you for being with us.
Louis, thank you so much for having me.
As I mentioned, that this is what some people are comparing as a modern version of Jane Eyre, and it's, I guess, the immigrant spin on Jane Eyre. And as I promised our listeners, we will ask you directly, is this what you intended to do from the moment you started writing this?
Well, I guess it was kind of a whole process. You know, when I was little, my mother used to say to me in her broken English, she's like, you act like orphan. And I never understood that. I mean, you either are one or you aren't. And I realized that her definition of an orphan is someone who acted in a way that, in a shameful way that disgraced their parents. So when I read George Jane, I was struck by these epithets that were thrown at her. You know, she was wicked, mischievous, friendless. And then later in grad school, I learned that these epithets very much reflected the Victorian construct of the orphan. So my mind kind of drew that link between the Korean post-war understanding of the orphan and the Victorian one, and this is kind of how that novel was born.
So is this novel kind of a partially biographical sketch of you?
My character Jane and I do share a lot of, you know, we have a lot of similarities. We both come from Flushing, Queens. You know, we grew up in the Korean community there. We kind of spent our whole lives riding the 7 trains, staring out at the Midtown Manhattan skyline and waiting for the day that we could just get out of Dodge. But Jane is different because she is half Korean and half white. She's an orphan. She's raised by her aunt and uncle. And it's kind of like her mother's shame, as it were, is manifest in her face, on her face, because Korean society up until recently was one that that prized ethnic homogeneity.
Now, when you start reading this book, you almost immediately want to take sides with Jane and help her because her uncle just seems so strict and almost like no feelings whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, the character of Sang is very interesting because he's a man of his generation. You know, he does not know how to express himself. He doesn't show emotion. And on top of that, he and Jane face language barriers, cultural barriers, generation gaps. But I'd like to think that as the novel goes on, you know, we develop a more kind of nuanced understanding of Sang, or rather Jane, as she accrues different experiences, has a reverse assimilation experience herself. She comes to view her uncle in a new light.
We're visiting with Patricia Park. Patricia is the author of the novel Re-Jane. When you're describing your living with your uncle, because this is your mother's brother, correct? I mean, Jane's brother?
Jane's mother's
brother. Mother's brother,
yes.
Excuse me. And she is older than her cousins?
Yes, she is.
Okay, now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so that adds an interesting dynamic, too, because the oldest you have more than a fair share of responsibility, and she was kind of burdened with that additional role as well.
And she also is, you know, as you mentioned, an orphan, and the fact that even her cousins who look down on her, and they're quick to remind her, as is her aunt and her uncle, the fact that you are lucky to be here because we're taking care of you. And they constantly remind her about the fact that her mother is not looked upon very nicely.
Well, her aunt definitely reminds her of that. I think her younger cousins are a bit kind of self-absorbed in a sense to even really acknowledge that or bring that question to light. But Jane, you know, she grows up constantly feeling as though she doesn't belong. That she should be lucky to have a place at the table. I mean, this is the way that she feels. And I think so many of us can relate to that experience of, we're stuck in this world that we just don't belong to, and you're just dying for an escape.
gosh, I forgot the character's name, but the lady who comes in and will constantly return stuff or demand things. And the
Mrs. O'Gall.
There you go. Tell us a little bit about that character.
She's a very minor character. So Jane just graduates college, and she goes back to working at her uncle's grocery store in Queens. You know, she's not able to line up a finance job in the midst of the dot-com bust. And there is this character of Mrs. O'Gall, who's a petite granny, Irish granny, and an Irish-American granny, who comes in and, you know, every week she buys her head of iceberg lettuce and a jar of mayonnaise. And then every following week she comes and returns it and keeps buying it in this cycle. And it's interesting because this is a moment where I feel that Jane's Uncle Fang shows some sympathy. You know, Jane's like, why do you let her keep returning it? And he says in his broken English, you know, she not do like this if she not have to. So I think as rigid as Fang is, as strict as he is and unemotive, there are these glimmers of humanity that I hope the reader will get to pick up on as well.
We're visiting with Patricia Park. Patricia is the author of the novel Rejane, and it's the genesis of, well, actually it's a modern version of Jane Eyre, and the character Jane is pretty much like a modern Jane Eyre. She works in her uncle's grocery store, but then she decides that she needs something better. She needs to change her plans because, as you mentioned, Patricia, in the book, the dot-com bust has gone on, but a lot of Patricia's friends are going on to bigger and better things. And
Jane's friends, right?
Jane's, I keep thinking to you, I'm sorry. Jane's friends. And then that one friend who has a boyfriend who applies at these dot-com companies, and they push her to kind of do something similar, but she's never prepared for what's about to land in her lap.
Yeah, I mean, that was not the expected road she was supposed to take. There's this wonderful character called Eunice, the one that you mentioned. You know, she just graduated from MIT and she's about to take a job with Google, which, as we know, in 2000 was nothing compared to Yahoo or any of the other big guys. And everyone's like, Eunice, why are you taking this job? What are you, crazy? But Eunice is the one that urges Jane to respond to a Village Voice ad advertising for an au pair because, you know, it does present some avenue for an escape and for a new life.
It's interesting, and I think readers will get a kick out of this when they read the actual one ad that Jane responds to because it's written in a very, very academic, almost like you need another book to try and translate and read up the citations.
Oh, thank you, Lee. I mean, that was fun. I think what I'm trying to do in Rejane is to play with a lot of language and discourse. I mean, for me, growing up, you know, my parents were Korean immigrants, well, Korean Argentine immigrants, and I was just surrounded in a world of other immigrants. So you could never take language for granted, or rather communication. And I worked in my parents' grocery store in Brooklyn, and you would hear every day so many different languages, so many different discourses and ways of talking, broken English, high English. And then when I went on to pursue higher ed, then I was faced with this other kind of discourse. So this novel is trying to capture all those different voices in their multiplicity and try to just unpack meaning from them.
When Jane responds to this and she goes down there and she meets Beth and Ed, it's very, why don't you tell us about what she runs into?
Jane boards the 7 train leaving Flushing and does the inefficient right angle through Manhattan to get to Brooklyn. And she shows up at this beautiful brownstone in, you know, brownstone Brooklyn. She meets a family so very unlike her own. The couple, her potential employers are academics, and they've hired, they're looking to hire an au pair for their daughter, who's an adopted from China. And for Jane, she just sees this glimpse like of an alternative version of her own adoption story. The family is just suffused with love and warmth, and Jane just keeps comparing it side by side with her own family situation. And she is struck by the irony that, hey, you know, I'm being raised by my own biological relations, and I don't even see, you know, a fraction of the love and warmth that this family seems to display. So it's very attractive to Jane.
We're visiting with Patricia Park. She is the author of the novel Rejane. And Patricia, one of the situations that Jane runs into is, and if you could explain to us, the nunchi, and that is the respect. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, nunchi is a concept that does not exist in, at least in the English language or maybe Western society, or it's untranslatable. It means something like anticipation or foresight. But basically, it's this ability to walk into a room, read the situation, and anticipate not only how you're supposed to behave, but everyone surrounding you. So it's kind of like a code of behavior. And Eunice's, Jane's friend Eunice, our MIT sci-fi loving friend, describes Nunchi as like the eye of Sauron. It's this kind of all-knowing stink eye that roves about and is trying to catch your every social misstep. So Jane, you know, growing up in a rather traditional Korean, albeit Korean-American household, she feels constantly this pressure to, you know, make sure I fill my elder's water glass before I fill my own, or, you know, always give up your seat without being asked to. So these are just observances and ways of behaving in a society that she's constantly hyper-vigilant about, and it makes for a rather kind of stifling experience.
When she is visiting Ed and Beth and she has to make a decision, she knows that there's going to be a problem there with Nunchi and that her uncle especially is not going to agree with her taking this job.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, one way that Nunchi kind of manifests itself, or maybe it's just cultural codes, is that when she's at home in Flushing with her uncle, if you go to the fridge, you feel like eating a piece of fruit, you go to the fridge and just, you know, cut a piece for yourself. That's considered selfish. You should just know, bring enough to the table, and then you peel it, and you cut it for everyone. But in the Mazur Farley household, where she comes to live in Brooklyn, it's not that way. She wrongly anticipates. She makes all these wrong, like false starts. And it really, in a classic kind of Bildungsroman or novel of education, the way that Jane Eyre is, Jane Rhee, my protagonist, is also on this path of getting an education.
That education that you talk about, and you mentioned fruit and peeling the fruit, she runs into that right away when she is eating with them and she does what she's used to and not realizing that she's done wrong.
Yeah, I mean, she just goes into autopilot right in the Brooklyn kitchen, and she starts peeling the fruit, and her boss, her new boss, Beth, is like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? Stop, you know. And it turns out all their fruit is organic, and all the nutrients are in the peel, so don't dare peel it. And Beth then imparts a bit of advice to her. If you're ever unsure of something, just ask questions, which runs completely counter to her immigrant uncle's, words to live by, which are, don't ask stupid questions. So Jane has many of these moments of cognitive dissonance, one foot in one kind of culture and another foot in the other, as she tries to navigate these two cultures and then define herself in relation to them.
At some point, also, Jane realizes that she is, I guess, admiring, and perhaps she is also seeing a part of her in Ed, the husband, because he doesn't really seem to fit in with Beth and her academic world. And Ed and Jane start meeting each other at the table for talks and snacks and other things late at night.
Yeah, so Ed is an interesting character because he's a native Brooklynite who has tried to rise up through academia. He's an English scholar along with his wife, but he does live in the shadow of his wife's success. And he cannot shake that outer borough, that Brooklyn accent. And it kind of permeates in all of his behaviors, too, which read as a little bit gritty, a little gruff, despite him actually being rather eloquent. But he and Jane bond over late-night sandwiches and just talk of that. You know, they both speak the same language of construction and building codes and, you know, HVAC systems and all of these things that Jane had to grow up with in the grocery store and living in the outer boroughs in Queens. And she and Ed kind of come together in sharing that language.
We're visiting with Patricia Park. Patricia is the author of the book, Read Jane. This is basically a novel about Jane Eyre. Modern Jane Eyre lives in Flushing, Queens, and she's orphaned as a baby. Her grandfather sends her away from South Korea to live with her uncle in the United States. And then, as Patricia's been discussing, she goes on to take a job on as an au pair with a very different family in the United States, and they're the Farley family. And there she also bonds with the daughter that she's supposed to look after and take care of her. And she ends up finding that this young lady looks up to her a lot and encourages her.
Yeah, Devon is an interesting character. I mean, she was, she's, you know, her parents adopted her from China when she was a little girl, and she grows up and lives a rather pampered life in Brooklyn. And yet she and Jane are kind of mirror images, or maybe almost opposites of each other. Jane doesn't look like she belongs with her family, yet she is part of the Korean culture. And for Devon, you know, people assume the two of them go to Chinatown together to buy some mooncakes, and the shopkeeper immediately addresses not Jane but Devon in Chinese, and she's expected to answer. And so I think for both of those characters, people look at them and make certain assumptions about, you know, who they are and where they're from. And in actuality, their identity is not what appears on the surface.
One of those stereotypes or things that Jane runs into throughout the book is something that perhaps, did you experience some of that, or do you feel like immigrants face some of that when they're growing up in a city, in a world that's just surrounded by modern United States, modern Korea, old-time Korea, the grandfather ways, the grandmother ways, and the fact that Jane has to goes to Korea to find out that it's very different from what she's heard. Is that something that perhaps you grew up hearing about, Patricia?
I certainly did. I mean, I was born and raised in New York, in America, and I guess I have claims to an American identity as much as any other American. Yet my whole life, I was always asked, you know, where are you from? No, where are you really from? And it just kind of creates that this mindset, at least for me, that where I was born and raised and where I planted my roots was not actually where I was from by virtue of the color of my hair and you know, the way my face looks. So for me, too, I was kind of spouting this rhetoric. Oh, you know, I was on a Fulbright grant to research this novel in Korea. And before I left, I kept saying, oh, I'm going back to the motherland. You know, I'm returning there. And I arrived there, and I was just as much a foreigner there as anyone else. So we can get into dangerous territory when, you know, hyphenated Americans like me are always told, oh, you know, where are you really from? So it just creates, again, the sense of not quite belonging.
Some of that comes across in the novel, Patricia. I think when the friend, other friend from academia visits them for Thanksgiving, and first of all, the Thanksgiving dinner turns out to be something completely different than Jane expects.
Yeah, I mean, that Thanksgiving dinner that Jane's boss Beth puts on is just the epitome of politically correct eating at the sake of actually tasting good. Or at the expense of it tasting good. They are visited by a renowned academic who was Beth's mentor, and the whole night is kind of spent pandering to his theories. And in that moment, I just wanted to show how all of these cultures and these languages are clashing at once. For me personally, again, I grew up from a very blue-collar background, and when I approach academia, and also, you know, when I started teaching at the college level, I was faced with these types, and I felt like none of us spoke the same language, or I didn't speak their language. And there's a sense of a linguistic hierarchy that happens sometimes when you cannot peddle the academic ease, even though a lot of those words are made up, or they're like gerundized nouns or something like that. So there is a, and to be self-indulgent, I was definitely poking fun at academia, or poking gentle fun at academia in that scene and in others from the book.
In the book, we're visiting with Patricia Park. She's the author of the novel Read Jane. In the book, Patricia, you, when you talk about language, you also bring in the language of the young people, and with Jane and her friends, they're using the "I am so into that," "Oh my God," a lot of that language that some of the young people use.
Yeah. So one of the challenges as a novelist is that you want to create a work that stands the test of time, right? You don't want the language to be too marred in colloquialisms or whatever slang is current at the time, because I mean it's like a carton of milk, right? It goes bad after a week. But through dialogue, I felt that was one way to kind of inject how people are talking at the time, because it is set in the distant past. And for Jane, she enters these new worlds, she's meeting new friends, and then when she goes to Korea, she's meeting young Koreans with whom she's never had contact. I mean, she's only known other Korean Americans. And she realizes how much the Korean she knew growing up in Queens was stuck in time. I mean, it was very much in amber. It was Korean from like the 1960s or so, or 70s, and it's like as if I were talking like a fuddy-duddy, like, gee golly, that's swell. So this is how Jane sounds, and then she meets these young Koreans and realizes that she's got some catching up to do.
With Ed, gosh, this character really comes out and stands out, and you almost feel sorry for him, but also want to back him up, because I'm sure, as you mentioned, that working in academia, you found out that there are a lot of different things that perhaps these academic people, myself included, that we do something front stage and then change around, as Irving Goffman said, and backstage, the fact that, hey, was that you really talking back there, or how come you're changing now? You're not the same person I knew. And Jane seems to be caught in the middle of what part to play wherever she is.
Yeah, I mean, and to go back to that scene at the Thanksgiving dinner table, there are all of these kinds of political machinations that happen. I mean, in academia, as I imagine in other industries or other fields as well, and the whole, hey, you get bonus points for speaking for talking the talk, but behind the scenes, hey, did you make sure to offer, extra credit to your students so that way your student evaluations can come out higher because you're up for tenure? So all of these considerations, and for Jane, I mean, she's just completely a fish out of water. She's just observing and, trying to make any sense of what's being presented in front of her.
And Ed's response at that point, I thought it was very interesting, because he said, "Why don't you just do more teaching instead of giving them extra credit?" And they're looking at him like, "What?"
Ed is a great character because he, like some of the other native Outer Borough characters in the novel, is a whistleblower. I mean, he just says it like it is. And I think that's something that we've really lost in our language today, or maybe in our world today, because we're so careful not to be kind of culpable, or maybe even legally accountable. So language becomes very slippery, and you never quite say what you mean. So Ed is like, hey, instead of trying to have these machinations and try to boost up your student evals by, bribing your students, why don't you just teach them? And I think it's a wonderful moment among others like that when, hey, let's just make things plain. And I think the novel in part does try to just make it plain, make things plain.
And no pun intended, playing Jane there is kind of, is trying to fit in Ed's world, Beth's world, and then her friend's world also. And I'm reliving here the part where her friend takes her shopping and then they want to go clubbing. And Jane is kind of like, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do here? I'm playing the part, but just to make them happy. And while she's there, her mind is back with Ed.
Yeah, there are quite a number of these kind of cringe worthy moments where we're riding along with Jane and she needs to sort things out in order to become a stronger person in the end. When I set out to write this novel, or rather I should back up, when I first read Jane Eyre, I mean, one of the beautiful things that struck me was how someone who self-identifies as poor, obscure, plain, and little can triumph. I mean, Jane Eyre owns it. And she's just such a departure from the conventionally beautiful Victorian heroine. And I wanted my novel to stay true to that. So Jane herself feels quite ugly, or at least quite plain, and often out of place or of an inferior standing in society. Yet she finds a way to come into her own and emerge with a stronger sense of self.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but perhaps for people who may not have read Jane Eyre, when they read your novel, they'll want to go back and read Jane Eyre. Now, there are different translations of that also, because some of them say, well, this has to be written in today's English, or we're going to translate it to this or that so it can be better. And so people might actually go back and read more from the Bronte sisters, from Jane Austen, and all these other great authors.
Yeah, I mean, I deliberately set out to make this book still stand alone. So if someone has never read Jane Eyre or they're not familiar with the story, they can still appreciate this book and nothing goes over their head. For those Bronte files, as they do approach Read Jane, I think they might take comfort in these little, aside references, or it could be quite fun to try to patch up, oh, what is this? How does this parlay back? We were talking about that Irish granny character, Mrs. O'Gall. That's a very subtle reference to a throwaway line that Ed Rochester says about, right before he proposes to Jane Eyre. I know of a great nanny position or governess position for you with, Mrs. O'Gall and Bitternut Lodge in I think it was Connacht, Ireland. So there are little instances like that. But on a more serious level, I think the themes run true, the sense of identity and self. And then also I do put a postmodern spin on it and talk about issues of immigration and just kind of cultural translatability. So that's kind of my take on the classic.
Well, Patricia, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Patricia Park. She is the author of the book Read Jane, and you can see the various reviews and also some excerpts from the book, if novel, if you go to Amazon.com or Google. Jane also has a Facebook page, Patricia Park, and so does Jane. But tell us, I guess, do you have an additional website that perhaps you'd like to invite the listeners to, Patricia?
Sure, yeah. I do have my own personal website. It's patriciapark.com. You can find an excerpt there, as well as reviews and more info about both the book and myself. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you. Pleasure was mine. We've been visiting with Patricia Park, author of Read Jane. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas El Paso Communication Department. Our thanks to our engineers, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.